This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Turul Mende, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Sophia Rahman about her new book, Gendering the Hadith Tradition, Recentering the Authority of Aisha, Mother of the Believers, published by Oxford University Press. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe let's start with about that you tell us a bit about yourself first, how you became an independent scholar, and you run an Instagram account as well where you post about books and your work sometimes. So maybe you can tell us about your journey a little bit first.
Sure. So thank you for having me and thank you for starting with such a fun question. So I began really to show an interest in Islam more from an intellectual perspective, I suppose, when I was still a teenager. So I was born into a Muslim family and, you know, as is par for the course, automatically assumed Islam as my religion. And then it was as a teenager where I decided I wanted to interrogate this faith that I've sort of just naturally assumed. Because I was interested in Allah, I was interested in God, I was interested in developing that relationship. I didn't have a problem with belief in God, but I wanted to be sure that this particular path that I had been set on was, you know, the right one. And you know, as teenagers are, you know, everything is so black and white, and truth is so easily accessed or assessed even. So that's where it really all began. I always had questions and I wanted answers, and you know, like an absolute curiosity about the world around me and its origins. And a belief in something greater and higher and more transcendent than myself and everything that I saw. As a university student, I actually did my undergraduate in business management and finance. So boring, so dull, but it was what I took up. But I had the opportunity to start to learn Arabic. I had the language option. So I took that up. And once I graduated, I moved to Syria to further my studies of Arabic. And I also took up other studies, you know, Tajweed, which is sort of the recitation of the Quran. I took up Fiqh, which is jurisprudence. It was whilst I was in Syria, I'd actually just gotten married and we'd moved out to Syria. My husband was already studying out there. He was a more advanced student. And we were in this obscure little bookshop in Damascus one day. And he got really excited at the sight of this book on the shelves. And I didn't know, you know, I didn't have a clue what had excited him. And he picked this book off the shelf. And he said, oh, look at this. He was like, this book, it's a collection of traditions of Aisha radiallahu anha, you know, Aisha, the wife of the Prophet Muhammad. And, you know, one day you're going to translate this. And I just thought, oh, what's the likelihood of that? But, you know, I continued to pursue my Islamic studies. We moved from Turkey. We moved back to the UK. We moved to Wales, where there used to be this wonderful little Islamic seminary. And both of us continued our studies there. Then we moved to Oxford. My husband was pursuing his PhD there. And we were having our family. Our family was growing. And then we moved to Turkey, where I took up private study out there with local scholars. And then when we came back to the UK, I decided to go back into academia. And that's where I started to study. I did my master's. And as I was doing my master's, I decided, you know, I'm going to pursue a PhD. And my dissertation for my MA was a partial translation of a few chapters, or not even chapters, actually a few pages of that very same book that my husband had gotten excited about in a Damascene bookshop almost 15 years earlier or 10 years earlier. And that was sort of the beginnings of my PhD study as well. So I progressed onto the PhD. And that was when I did a partial translation and critical study, a deeper critical study of this text, which was Al-Ijaba, which is a 14th century text written by Imam Az-Zarkashi. What was so remarkable about this text is that it's a collection of over 200 statements of Aisha, the wife of the Prophet Muhammad, where she is refuting or correcting, and in some cases corroborating, statements by predominantly male companions of the Prophet who were attributing statements to the Prophet. And she makes some very important interventions, and, you know, ones that run counter to some of the more normative ways in which we think about Islamic jurisprudence, for example, or interpretations of the Quran, or attitudes towards women. And so, first of all, that was in itself remarkably important, and you know, it was not only important, but it was also exploratory. It opened up a new way of looking at established ways of thinking about especially women and Islam. Also, what was interesting was that, you know, Imam Az-Zarkashi wrote this text and then dedicated it to the Qadi al-Qudat in his time, the chief judge of his time, indicating that he wanted it to be a book that influenced the way that the most powerful scholarly elite, legal elite, were thinking about Islam. And yet this text was almost lost to us as well. So the manuscript for this book was, you know, first found in by Al-Afghani in a library in Syria, and then later on another manuscript was found by a Turkish professor, Arul, in the 90s in Istanbul. And yet, despite these two discoveries of these two manuscripts, not much was done with this work. And I think I can see why. There's a number of reasons why. It's very challenging, some of the statements of Aisha. You know, she's really a resistant sort of mechanism within the Hadith tradition to anything that countered the egalitarian impulse of Islam, anything that countered the loving approach to especially women that Islam was establishing. You know, she's very resistant to that. And so, you know, the book offered so much. And so it was very exciting for me to have had the opportunity to work on it. And that was my journey.
Thank you so much. And can you explain us the title, what you mean by gendering the Hadith tradition in particular?
Yeah, so, I mean, so the title is Gendering the Hadith Tradition, Recentering the Authority of Aisha, Mother of the Believers. And I think that this was essentially what she was doing. You know, she was gendering the ways in which we thought about things. You know, she was questioning the normativity of reading Islam through a male lens only. And I don't want to say patriarchal at this point, but, you know, essentially that is the route that it then leads down when we only look or we only consider a male lived experience, and even then a very particular male lived experience vis-a-vis Islam. It doesn't allow for other perspectives and other lived experiences to inform that. And we see that very much in the ways in which Aisha challenged statements that were made around her. So, for example, there's one instance where in her company, it is mentioned that women who do not have a mahram, a maid, who don't have a mahram, who is a male guardian, mustn't travel. And it's a really powerful image that is portrayed in this instance where, you know, this statement is made by a male companion. And rather than directly refuting him, Aisha turns to the women that are around her in that instance and says, "And how many of you have a male guardian?" And there's multiple things that she's doing in that moment. You know, she's almost provoking those in the audience. You know, she's saying to the women around her that don't just accept what you're hearing without challenging it or without critically thinking about it or without allowing your own lived experience to impose itself on this statement. If a woman is told, "Oh, you cannot travel without a mahram," and she doesn't have a mahram, that could put her in a lot of difficulty if she has family in a different town or a different city, or if she has to travel for work or study or education or any number of reasons for her health. You know, to limit her travel would be a severe inconvenience. She may have a male guardian, but one who is not capable or able to conveniently travel with her when she needs it. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why that could be a very problematic statement in the life of a Muslim woman who just accepts that unquestioningly. So she presents in that moment, you know, a response that not only questions the original statement, but it also encourages those who are in audience to be permitted to apply their own critical thinking to the statement at hand, and not to just assume that if somebody says, "Qala Rasulullah," the messenger of Allah said, that they can't question it. And I think that that's a really important, again, a really important part of her pedagogy as well, that she is empowering. And I think it's very much in line with the methodology of the Prophet Muhammad himself, and also in line with what Allah advocates for in the Quran by consistently asking those who are reading it, "Will you not think? Will you not look? Will you not ponder? Will you not question?" And in line with that, then she is also saying to those around her, "Does this make sense? Is this fair? Does this sit well with your lived experience? Does this expand your agency as a human being, or does it limit it?" She's allowing for that to happen. And she's allowing that to happen because, A, she herself is a woman. So, you know, she may have felt something immediately in that moment that perhaps a male companion wouldn't have been able to appreciate, because it's not something that's impinging on their freedom of movement. And also because she was somebody who was deeply engaged with her community. She was well aware of the affairs of her community, much like her husband, who is also known to have, you know, been stopped on the road and, you know, asked questions by women of his community and giving them that time, sometimes even delaying getting to the prayer because he's stopped to speak to a woman who's asked him a question and he's given her that time. So Aisha was somebody who was steeped in her community and well aware of their concerns. and was a guardian in that regard of the faith as well, ensuring that those who are so easily marginalized, attempting at least not to allow that to happen. When we look at the first believers, the first to heed the call of the Prophet Muhammad to respond to his message, they were the marginalized, as is often the case. You know, we see that with Jesus in the Christian in the Christian religion too. We see that in many faiths, that the first to respond to prophets are often those who do sit on the margins of society. So that was women, it was children, it was the enslaved. And so she is carrying on that legacy. And part of that is very much ensuring that women are heard and that their lived realities are considered. And so, yes, so gendering the hadith tradition was about saying we're going to read the hadith tradition and we're going to read it in the way that Aisha, or one of the ways in which Aisha did so, which is to say that women's lived realities matter and we are going to consider them as we read the hadith tradition. And the recentering of Aisha's authority, well, speaks for itself. You know, in many ways, I think what this study shows is that there were many statements of hers which met the criteria of the most sound tradition. So we know that Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim and their criteria for what was considered a sound tradition from the Prophet Muhammad or a strong tradition from the Prophet Muhammad, that same criteria could be applied to other hadith which didn't make it into the canon. And that is something that Imam Zarkashi shows as well, that there are multiple times when there are statements of Aisha's which counter those that have gone on to be canonized and are just as strong as them in their sanad, so in their chain of narration. But, you know, for varying reasons, didn't fall into those texts that then became canonized. And so, you know, there's also a reconsideration of what we consider canon as well. And, you know, an encouragement that I present in the book to look outside of the canon. And at the same time, I acknowledge that looking outside of the canon doesn't mean that we're going to, you know, find therein all of the anti-patriarchal traditions. It's, you know, there may continue to be traditions that challenge us as well. But that's why I also then, in one of the chapters of my book, present what I call the emerging methodology of Aisha, that there's a particular methodology that she presents, or that I extract rather from my study, that also allows us to then, you know, continue in the same vein, in the same spirit of Aisha, when we are looking at the traditions of the Prophet and navigating this enormous body of work that's out there that can sometimes be quite contradictory when we are deciding as believers, or if we are reading as people wanting to understand the faith of Islam better. You know, what was the methodology that Aisha sort of indicates in her own processing of prophetic hadith? And that I think is really important when we're moving forward as well and are faced by contradictory traditions.
Yes, thank you so much, Sophia. And how was your selection process during your research? How did you decide what to include into your work and what to leave out? So how hard was it for you to choose from the material that you had?
Yeah, so what I mean, because I was using the single text Al-Ijaba for my thesis, it was quite straightforward in the sense that I knew I was going to only take extract from within the text. Originally, I was very ambitious. I thought I was going to translate the whole text, and I was soon put in my place with that expectation. So what I did was I separated all of the hadith that were in that text, all of the traditions, into particular themes. And I found that there were certain themes that were just repeated. So the traditions that I selected were those that represented all of the themes that then come up in the book. So although I didn't translate the entire book, I did translate everything that is present within the book as a theme. However, what happens then is that you're still left with traditions that you want to, that you do still want to explore further. And then, as is the case with research, you know, you end up down various rabbit holes. And I was finding that there were other traditions that were also falling within this genre of this book, which is, you know, of Aisha refuting other male companions. I was finding similar traditions outside that, you know, that hadn't been recorded in this text. And some of those made their way into my thesis, but I had the great fortune then when I finished my PhD of being approached by Cube Publications to contribute to their Treasury series. So the Treasury series is a series of books where they invite scholars who are specialists in a particular field or on a particular personality to write a book which contains 40 statements of that particular personality or that particular field of Islamic studies, along with commentary by the scholar. So they asked me if I would contribute to the series on Aisha. So I then wrote a book for them, which was published last year, called A Treasury of Aisha, A Guidance from the Beloved of the Beloved. And so many of the sort of the statements of Aisha that I had found whilst I was doing my PhD that didn't make it into the thesis, I then I then fed into this book instead. And so for this book, I split up the themes into five themes. So there's the tafsir of Aisha, there's the fiqh, the jurisprudence of Aisha, there's a chapter on Aisha on matters of aqidah, so on creed, and then a chapter on Aisha's political influence, so her siyasa sharia, and then a fifth chapter on Aisha on heart softeners, which is like, called ar-raqa'iq in Arabic. It's a branch of Islamic faith, which is about one's character and developing one's character in a way that is in line with the prophetic character. And then the final chapter of that book is lessons that can be gleaned from a particular incident in the life of Aisha, which came to be known as Al-Ifk, the great slander against Aisha. So I was between the two books, between A Treasury of Aisha and Gendering the Hadith Tradition, you know, I was able to pull in lots of different aspects of Aisha's life and statements made by Aisha, which are, you know, really represent, a counter narrative in many ways. You know, when we think about how, in sort of like hegemonic iterations of Islam, when we think about how women or the ideal Muslim woman is presented, she's quite often presented as someone who's demure, quiet, unquestioning, compliant, respectful. But then we see in Aisha a character that runs counter to all of that. You know, she was questioning, she was feisty, she she spoke up, she raised her voice, she raised an army when she believed that was the right thing to do. She was visible, she was politically engaged, she held her political leaders to account. She was rebellious. You know, her home and the home of Umm Salama became a point of, you know, gathering and organizing and rebellion when they believed that Uthman ibn Affan, the third caliph, was behaving in ways that they thought was incorrect. You know, they accused him of nepotism. And, you know, in many ways that runs counter to how we are often taught or expected to consider what the ideal Muslim woman looks and behaves like. So, you know, for me, she's just this, she's a door of possibilities for Muslim women, and a door of possibilities not just for Muslim women first, but also everyone thereafter as well. You know, she's a window into what could be. You know, she allows us to think critically about our faith. She allows us to ask questions. She allows us, not only allows us, but demands of us that we bring our own lived experience to our faith, that we apply the Quran first to our faith, that if something doesn't feel right to us because it doesn't align with what we know that has been stated in the Quran, then we should be allowed to question statements that are being attributed thereafter to the Prophet. She allows us to just apply our good sense to what we are being told as well. There are times when people say things to her and she exposes quite frankly, the stupidity of what might be being said or the impracticability of what might be being said. So, you know, I'll give an example of that where, you know, it's presented to her that the cloth on the Kaaba, you know, that should be burnt. You know, when it's being replaced, it should just be burnt rather than used in any other kind of way. And she's really irritated by this suggestion, you know, that this cloth, because it has been draped over the Kaaba, somehow has now been infused with a sacredness that doesn't allow it to be used by anybody else for any good purpose, so therefore it should just be burnt. And she says, no, cut it up and sell it in the markets. You know, let people make use of it. I mean, now we talk about sustainability, don't we? And we talk about how, you know, fast fashion and the way that the world is, you know, this capitalist world that we live in with is hyper-consumerism and just how damaging that is. And we see quite often religions and, you know, Islam is no different to this being also being made victim to capitalist ideals and capitalist endeavors. I mean, there's almost a, you know, she's saying no to wastage and no to this very superficial way of thinking about spirituality and the sacred, whilst also recognizing that, you know, there's a sense of sustainability, of an opportunity for sustainability here, and an opportunity for people to benefit from this cloth that was on the Kaaba. It may have been on the Kaaba. It's no longer useful for the Kaaba. It can be used in other ways now. So, you know, this practical way in which she approaches things as well. So she's somebody who is deeply rooted in the faith. She understands it. She has an insight of it because of her own relationship to God, which we see in incidents like the slander, like the ifk that I mentioned earlier. But she's also somebody who is deeply rooted in her community. So she understands her community's needs. She was somebody that people came to when they had questions. She was somebody who people came to when they had doubts about what they had heard. She was somebody who, advised political leaders of her time. She not only advised, but she also, challenged them in her time. She was an educator, so somebody who knew the needs of her community as well. And also, of course, she lived with the Prophet Muhammad. So she got a behind the scenes understanding of what the prophetic mission was. So really, she was in the perfect position to then act as a safeguard of the religion too after the Prophet passes.
Thank you so much. And while translating the texts for your research, what kind of maybe method did you use, or what difficulties did you come across while translating them, because they are maybe a bit technical for some parts anyway, and how did you use it with your own words, or did you try to render it in your own words?
Yeah, so this is another great question. I think anybody who's done a PhD or any sort of research will know that sometimes we go in with certain ideas and expectations, and then we are very quickly humbled. So this was another point on which I was quite quickly humbled. I remember as I was doing the thesis, my supervisor, Rachel Muir, she said to me, mention something about your methodology. It needn't be more than a paragraph or two. And it ended up being an entire chapter, because what I found was that there was very little actually written on methodology of translation for hadith. And even in terms of methodology for translation of the Quran, that was quite limited as well. I also knew that I wanted to take a, sort of gender aware approach to translating the hadith. I wanted to ensure that when I was translating, I was doing so in a way whereby the language was inclusive. When you have a language like Arabic, where everything is very gendered, it's very easy to then translate that in ways that into English in ways that are not necessarily inclusive. So the Muslim then becomes default male, when translated into English. And so I wanted to be careful of things like that, where I am not translating in a way that makes the Muslim default male always, but that it's more inclusive. So that ended up being an entire chapter. I was also careful about not translating in ways that, are orientalizing either. I didn't want to translate in a way that maintained Islam in this paradigm of being othered always, or being exotic, or being unreachable, something that is beyond our current lives and what is relevant in the here and now. So I took an approach, I leaned on works by people such as Simmons, who writes about translating or feminist translation methodologies, whereby we are conscientious of gender when we are translating. I was also careful about the lucidity of language. So I was considerate of the fact that although I'm translating from Arabic into English, literal translations don't always work. They can end up being florid, or they can end up being chunky and not really working so well in the English language. So I was careful about things like that as well. And I was also, I also kept my translation in conversation with the Quran. So if I knew that a word had been used in the Quran in a particular way, I would be careful to translate accordingly. So these were some of the considerations that I had as I was as I was translating, by way of slight digression, I did actually write an essay for an anthology that was published last year as well by Tilted Axis. It's called Violent Phenomena, and it's 21 essays on decolonizing translation. So I have a chapter in there as well where I talk about, you know, decolonizing translation and thinking about translation of hadith through that lens as well.
Thank you so much, Sophia. And how does gendering the hadith tradition fit into your overall research? Is it something that you will continue to work in your future projects, or is it something that is a, like a closed chapter now?
It's definitely my intention to translate the entirety of Al-Ijaba. I think that it would be a dream come true to have Al-Ijaba in the household of every Muslim family's, personal library, much in the way that we have the Quran on our shelves, or many of us have Bukhari or Muslim on our shelves. I would love to have Al-Ijaba on the shelf of Muslim homes as well. So certainly that's something that I would like to do. The next sort of, I'm interested in liberation theology more broadly, and I think that this is, you know, in the same spirit of wanting to bring women in from the margins. I'm also very interested in disability theology, and I'm especially interested in autism and the autistic experience. I think there's very little research done on that, especially with regards to Islam and autism. But I have an interest in seeing how certain autistic traits or traits that are often associated with autism, what they have to inform us, in what ways could they potentially inform us. So I'm interested in looking at three attributes that are often associated with folk that have autism, and that those three things are around gender, time, and nonverbal communication, and what we can understand of God around those three things too, because there are some, I think that there are insights that the autistic experience can give to us in understanding God on those three things too. So just as we know in Islamic theology, Allah is neither male nor female, quite often these binaries are constructions that autistic folk struggle to fall between one or the other, that they experience gender in a much more fluid way than these binaries allow. And time as well is a construct that they don't necessarily experience in the same way that neurotypical folk do. That there's a fluidity there as well. We know that God resides outside of time. And the third being communication, that quite often verbal communication is not the way in which autistic folk may want to or be able to communicate always. And what I find interesting is that in Islam we have the notion that Allah has revealed three books, so in many ways spoken, verbally communicated three times, and then not thereafter. But that doesn't mean that Allah isn't communicating. There are, you know, in the Quran, we're constantly told, you know, readers are told that, you know, look at the ayat of Allah, look at the signs of Allah, that there, and the ayat, these signs of Allah are means by which Allah is communicating. But it's not verbal, it's not wahi, it's not revelation. You're not receiving a book, you're not receiving the word of God. The word of God only came to this, to this land, to these people, to the world three times according to Muslim belief. But that doesn't mean that God isn't communicating. So I'm interested in liberation theology, and within that, disability theology, and within that, I'm interested in bringing in the autistic experience and what we can learn through that about, you know, theological perspectives on God from within the Muslim tradition.
Thank you so much, Sophia, for providing us insight into your work and your research. And thank you so much for being on the podcast today with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.